Chapter 3.
"The Matthew is docked, my lord," announced the secretary. "They're bringing the prisoners up to the castle now."
"Excellent," said the lord. "Inform the constable and tell him to see them locked in the gate tower, except O'Donnell's son. Have him brought to the castle chamber. I wish to question him myself."
"Very good, my lord."
The secretary withdrew. Sir John Perrault rubbed his hands and smiled. At last, he thought. This would silence the wolves snapping at his heels. He knew of the plots against him, the whispered tales carried back to the Privy Council in London. Well, let them intrigue. This time he had outwitted. In a daring plot, he had managed to keep the best hostages from all of Tyrconnell. The O'Donnell and that Scottish harrion of a wife of his could now be brought to heel. The Queen would acknowledge his statesmanship, and Dublin would be obliged to follow suit. Oh, how his enemies on the council would squirm. They would puke with envy, and he would rub their noses in it. He smoothed his ruff, set the lace at his cuffs, and made his way down to the castle chamber. Stephen Seagar, the constable of Dublin Castle, escorted the prisoner in.
"Master O'Donnell, my lords," he announced, thrusting into the room a bundle of rags that looked and smelt as if it had been plucked off the nearest dunghill.
The company stared and dabbed scented handkerchiefs to their noses. Perrault blinked in amazement. There must be some mistake. Could this creature really be Hugh Roe O'Donnell, the golden child around whom these ridiculous prophecies had been spun? It looked more like a drowned rat fished out of a cesspool. He sighed. One forgot sometimes, here in Dublin, how savage the untamed Irish really were. Scratch any one of their so-called princes, and you'd find a flea-bitten wolf underneath. "Faugh!" he said disgustedly. "He stinks like a polecat!"
"He has been confined for several days in the hold of a ship, my lord," one of his councillors, Sir Lucas Dillon, pointed out reasonably. "In chains and probably quite seasick."
Perrault was unconvinced. Dillon was his friend, indeed his chief stay on the council. But deep within he had Irish blood. He probably felt compelled to defend this little creature. Perrault knew better. He could not imagine any English gentleman allowing himself to sink to that state, no matter what the circumstances. Wrinkling his nose, he moved forward to inspect his catch more closely. The brat had his head down and was wrapped from head to foot in one of those barbaric Irish clothings. All Perrault could see of him was a tangle of red hair and one thin hand that crept out to hold the edge of his cloak together. He was shivering, but whether from fear or cold, it was impossible to tell. After a moment, the boy looked up. His other hand came out from his cloak and scraped the matted hair from his eyes. For the first time, Perrault saw his face. God's death! The little guttersnipe had been brawling too. His left eye was swollen shut, and both cheeks were a mass of welts and bruises. Clearly, there could be little intelligence in such a creature.
"I bid you good day, Master O'Donnell," Perrault said briskly. "I am sorry your father's stubbornness has obliged us to bring you here by force."
The silent figure gave no indication of having understood or even heard his words. Lucas Dillon translated them into Irish. The boy looked at Dillon. He seemed to be thinking. Then he looked at Perrault. He fixed the Lord Deputy his one good eye and said clearly
and carefully. And that is the first lie. You have neither sorrow nor shame. You rejoice in your lies.
Latin! The disgusting little animal spoke perfect Latin. The result, no doubt, of a popish Catholic education. Perrault thought rapidly. He would have to pick his words with care. It was entirely possible that the little savage spoke the language better than he did. But Perrault could hardly insist that Lucas Dillon translate everything. He hesitated a long time before speaking again.
"Funny you should mention lies," he said first in Latin. "Master O'Donnell, when I have it on good authority that your own father is planning to disinherit his eldest son, who has done him no wrong I have heard of, in order to make you his heir."
The boy looked baffled.
"You speak in riddles," he said.
"Have you not an older brother?"
"A half-brother. What of it?"
"By law, he stands before you in the line of succession."
"By whose law?"
"By English law. By the law of all civilized kingdoms."
The boy laughed softly.
"A foolish law indeed, my lord deputy, that disinherits strong men and gives power to women and weaklings. Our Brehon law gives authority to the ablest man."
He paused and looked Perrault full in the face. "Even bastards." Perrault felt every eye in the room turn to look at him. His prisoner smiled. Perrault wanted to wipe that insolence off his face. He restrained himself with an effort.
"And what does that accomplish?" he asked coldly. "But to set every man within bowshot of a title against his rivals. Uncle against nephew, cousin against cousin. Why, men murder their own brothers over your Gaelic titles."
"But do they execute their wives?" said Hugh Roe O'Donnell softly. "Two, wasn't it? Anne Boleyn, Catherine Howard?"
It was too much. John Perrault, bastard son of King Henry VIII, roared like a baited bull and swung a blow calculated to snap the boy's neck.
But Lucas Dillon stepped in the last minute.
"Let it go," he urged, seizing the enraged man by the arm. "The boy is angry and exhausted, but he doesn't know what he's saying."
But it was quite obvious that the brat knew exactly what he was saying.
He stood there, wrapped in his filthy blanket, and stared at the Lord Deputy with all the arrogance of an emperor. Perrault struggled with his rage. He choked on it, gurgling like a man cut living from the gallows. His fists clenched and unclenched continuously. At last, with a supreme effort, he mastered himself.
"Out!" he roared. "Take him from my sight before I kill him!"
Seagar didn't want to be told twice. He seized his prisoner by the shoulders and propelled him towards the door. The boy twisted in his grasp and lifted his head to hurl a parting insult, but Seagar clapped a hand over his mouth and shoved him through the door before he could speak.
"Ah, didn't you tell him, though?" chuckled Owen O'Gallagher, still gloating 2 weeks later over the humiliation of their captor. "And him with his pride all over him like muck on a pig's back?"
Hugh sighed. Owen's way of coping with captivity seemed to be treated like it was some sort of game. A verbal hurling match, with every insult a goal for the Irish side. But Owen had not confronted the Lord Deputy. Hugh knew the truth. They were powerless. Perrault could do whatever he liked with them. His own bravado in the castle chamber had been no more than the courage of a mouse squeaking insults from behind the jaws of a cat. He stood up restlessly and went to look out the window. At least, so far, they had been spared the underground dungeon of his nightmares. They were housed in a room at the top of the gate tower, and though they were locked in for much of the time, it was a pleasant enough prison, with decently furnished
and with windows, overlooking the bridge. From his perch on the windowsill, Hugh looked north, towards the River Liffey, to watch the comings and goings between the castle and the wharfs. He had never seen a town as large as this before, and if they were all like this, he never wanted to see another. It was so dirty. The streets were grey, the houses were grey, even the sky seemed permanently overcast, and the breeze blowing off the river carried with it the stench of the wharfs, a mixture of fish, sewage, and rotting vegetables. There was also another smell, when the wind was in the correct direction. None of the boys ever spoke about it, but they knew exactly what it was. On the way up from the ship, Seagar had pointed out to them the spikes above the castle gate, and the trophies impaled on them, the grinning, sightless heads rotting in the weather. Irish heads, the constable had told them, a warning to any would-be rebels of the fate that befell all traitors to the crown. Today, the wind was in the east, so they were spared the lesson. Hugh shivered. "It's raining again," he said, peering down. Owen laughed. "And why wouldn't it? Even the sky spits on the Englishmen." "But it doesn't have to spit on us as well. They'll not let us into the yard today, and it raining." Owen shrugged. He lifted a playing piece from the board on the table and plonked it down again, triumphantly. "There, get out of that tunnel, if you can." His voice almost cracked with glee, and despite himself, Hugh felt his interest rising. He had yet to see Donal lose a game of fickle. He slid from the window and came over to watch. Donal frowned. He studied the board for a moment, then reached out and shifted one of his own pieces. "You spoke too soon, Owen. It's only two moves there are open to you now, and you're a dead man whichever way you jump."
"Nonsense!"
Owen's hand shot out confidently, but then paused and hovered uncertainly above the board. Donal chuckled.
"Ah, to hell with it for a stupid game anyway," said Owen.
He pushed his chair back from the table and stood up.
"Where's the skill in pushing counters around a board?"
"You're too fiery, Owen," Donal told him. "You rush into battle without studying the field, and doesn't it bring you down every time?" Owen snorted and muttered something uncomplimentary, but his friend only laughed.
"You'll learn," he said.
He held the pieces out to Hugh. "Will you try your hand, Hugh Rowe?" Hugh shook his head. In the mood he was in, he would be no match for Donal. He wished he had the young McSweeney's temperament. Donal had adapted to captivity better than any of them. He went back to the window. Donal cleared the board and set himself up a practice game. Owen paced the floor.
"I'm sick of this damn room," he exploded. As if on cue, there was a knock at the door.
They looked at one another, hopefully. It must be a visitor, for which of their jailers ever bothered to knock?
"Come in," said Hugh,
and the door opened to admit Sir Lucas Dillon. Dillon had visited them several times, and Hugh and Donal, at least, were always pleased to see him. He was one of the few men about the castle who seemed to have any concern for their welfare. He smiled at the boys.
"I came to see if they're still treating you decently," he said.
"They're feeding us," growled Owen.
"Are they now? Then let you be thankful for small mercies. Is there anything you need?"
"We need our freedom."
"My sorrow, but that's the one thing I can't give you. However," the man put down a pile of books, "I thought these might help pass the time."
Hugh pounced on them and thumbed through them eagerly.
"But they're all written in English," he said in disappointment. "And we have no English, any of us."
Dillon looked at him sideways.
"Then perhaps it might pay you to learn." "The devil it might," sputtered Owen. "Is it ourselves to be aping English ways?"
Dylan smiled. I know it's a little liking you have for the English, but would it not make sense, you live among them, to learn their language?
It would not. I'd rather be dead.
And so you may be, and you not learning to curb your tongue, Dylan sighed patiently. Can you not understand, lad? Times are changing. The old ways, the old customs, they're dying. Slowly, perhaps, but the end is inevitable. England has strength and patience. Eventually, she will win. His words went through Hugh like a knife. What was it Donald's father had said? They have it in their minds to govern us, Hugh, to destroy the clan system, to abolish Breton law, to impose their English laws in its place. He shivered, as if an icy wind had blown through the room. Looking up, he saw Lucas Dillon watching them. There was sympathy in the man's face, but it didn't seem to comfort him. Owen, seething with indignation.
She will not win, he said fiercely. We will fight her every step of the way.
And so you will, said Dillon sadly. When you are not too busy fighting each other. You are your own worst enemies, and that's the sorrow of it. You're too proud to be led, because you will not have an Irish king. In the end, you'll have to submit to an English queen.
Ha! And she to be bending her own knee over to the King of Spain before next year's out!
What did you say? Dylan rounded on the boy, his face white with shock.
You little idiot! Don't you ever utter such words again, if you want to keep your head in your shoulders!
Owen was taken by surprise, but he scowled.
And is it not what everyone is saying? That King Philip is now fitting out an armada to blow your navy off the seas?
They don't say it here, said Dylan grimly. And no more will you, and you haven't the sense you are born with.
Why, if the council believed you had the slightest inkling of any Spanish plot...
Hugh and Donald stared at each other. He'll not speak of it again, promised Hugh.
He's no fool. For all he has is a big mouth.
See that he doesn't, said Dylan. For if they decide to question him, I'll not be able to save him. He looked hard at Owen.
You understand what I'm trying to say to you?
Owen muttered under his breath.
Answer me! All right, then I do.
Then let you not forget it. Owen remained subdued for some weeks after Dylan's visit. Obviously the warning had shaken him more than he would admit. They had all heard tales of the interrogations that took place in the castle dungeons. Eventually, however, his optimism got the better of him. The Spanish rumours had refused to go away, and if Sir Lucas Dillon was unwilling to discuss them, there were others less reluctant. Stories jumped round like fleas around the castle yard, and like fleas, they fattened on every man who carried them. Owen carried all of them back to the safety of the gate tower after each exercise period, to be repeated in gleeful whispers after the guards had barred the door and departed for the night. The months passed, Christmas came and went, winter gave way to spring, and the whispers grew to an alarming rumble. 500 ships, 1,000, 2,000, the greatest armada ever assembled. They had already left Cadiz. They were at Coruna. They had already set sail for the English coast.
They're coming like Finn and his Fianna, crowned the Irish horse boys, to help the Irish in their hour of need.
I hear they're swarming like the hordes of hell, one of the English soldiers, with orders from the Pope to destroy the English nation. They carry wrecks and tomscrews in their holds and nooses to hang the good God-fearing Protestants.
By May, the castle was in a frenzy. Everyone told a different story, and everyone claimed to have the truth. Hugh didn't know what to believe. Conflict seemed certain. The fear on the garrison was something you could almost smell. But whether the news was as good as the rumours suggested was an entirely different matter. Donal treated the stories with scepticism, but Owen refused to entertain doubts.
We'll be out of here by Christmas, he insisted repeatedly. And the row of ugly English heads grinning down on us from the pikes above the gate as we go.
And the pity of it is that Perrault will not be one of them,
said Donal dryly. He winked at Hugh. My soul, hasn't he the luck on him? And him, being recalled now to England, and leaving next month? The new Lord Deputy will look well enough in his place, retorted Owen. And sure, there are enough spikes in London for Sir John Perrault. They can stick him up beside his red witch of a sister, and we'll all go over and throw mud at them. Hugh and Donal could only look at each other and shake their heads. Well, I'll tell you this for nothing, said Donal with a chuckle. If the Spanish do come here, they'll not want to be landing in the west. And if the rocks and tides don't get them, sure the O'Malleys will.